I started working on film after I had gotten tenure at Boston College, which is where I was before I came to Baylor in philosophy, and I finished a sabbatical. I had written a book on Aquinas that I was set out to write at the end of my tenure period. I thought I had a summer with nothing to do for the first time since maybe since like my junior year in college. And so you get in a mode when you're trying to get tenure where you're writing constantly, at least if you were scared as I was that you might not get tenure, you just write constantly. And so I thought, I've got some ideas about television and film, and that became eventually this book, Shows About Nothing, which is about film and TV. The title, some of you will be dated by this, but that was from a Seinfeld episode, Show About Nothing. One of the reasons I got interested in writing about film, and this will lead into the talk tonight, is that when I was in the philosophy department at Boston College, we had something like 300 majors, which was a lot of philosophy majors. I think for that size university, we had the most of any place in the country. And these were bright students, and many of them had philosophy as a second major, so they were majoring in finance or pre-med or whatever. And we had a good department, a lot of good teachers. Peter Crapes, great Catholic writer who was in the department, and I was happy to be his colleague. But I found that the students, despite being bright and despite actually being interested in philosophy, were failing to kind of make connections between what we're reading in class and thinking about their own lives. And of course, you don't bring this up in class. You don't want true, as a professor at least, I don't want true confessions from students in class, because those can go awry pretty quickly. You may just keep those for the confessional or for outside context with friends. But what you do want, I think, as a teacher, particularly at a Catholic university, is you hope that the students are making connections between what they're studying and how they live, and that they're bringing questions about their own life to bear upon what they're doing in class. And so I began teaching a class there on film and philosophy. I did it for, I think, 3 semesters in a row before I left there to go to Baylor. But I found that using film was a way of getting students to engage more directly, because film is a distinct artistic medium, and it hits us with images and stories, and it addresses not just our minds, but our imagination, and our hearts, and our passions, and our emotions. So I had conversations that I would never have otherwise had with students in class that were not true confessions, but they were students engaging at a deep level with what they saw on film and how it made them think about their own lives. There were some really remarkable moments the first semester I taught this class. And so I have continued since that time to be interested in film and to be interested in the way in which film as a distinct art form, as a distinct medium, can help us explore sort of deep questions about our lives, as all art can. I'm also interested in, I'm not a C.S. Lewis expert. I've worked with colleagues at Baylor who are C.S. Lewis experts, but I've read Lewis since I was early in college. He was really important for me when I, having been raised Catholic, got to college at the University of Maryland, where I started before I went to the University of Dallas, and was really challenged, first-generation college student, really challenged by a culture and a number of professors who were deeply skeptical about religion and theology, and it shook me up. And so Lewis was one of the people that I was advised to read as a young college student, and who's meant a lot to me over the years. Lewis himself, it's really interesting, the legacy of Lewis. I think he's as alive today as an influence as he was when he died in the early 60s. It's actually astonishing. And if you pick up his fiction or you pick up his essays, I think particularly his essays, his writing, he's a brilliant writer, very clear. He's actually a model writer if you want to learn how to write in a way that you can write about important things, but in ways that are as clear and accessible. Lewis is someone worth studying. But the way he approaches questions is still very, I mean, other people I read from that period who were writing in the 50s and 60s, you think there's insight here, but it doesn't read as fresh as someone like Lewis. Lewis is still fresh. Lewis is also really interesting for this topic of sort of theology and philosophy and art and then film. He didn't have a lot to say about film, so I'm going to be speculating a little bit. It's kind of applied or expanded Lewis. But he did have a lot to say about art. And, of course, he wrote. And one of the interesting things about Lewis as an artist, whether it's in literature or other other forms, is that Lewis was interested in art as a medium that communicates indirectly. So even the, I mean, his children's books, which are more directly kind of like the Narnia books, which are more directly, you could read the Christian message pretty quickly in those books. But even there, what Lewis wants us to do is to go through one world and into another, right? So you go in, you go into a coat rack and end up appearing on the other side in Narnia. For Lewis, art is about the expansion of the imagination. Think about Screwtape Letters, which is still a really ingenious text. And everybody's writing about, Christians writing about how we behave in order to get to heaven, how we behave. Lewis says, I'm going to do something different. Right? I'm going to imagine a scenario where there's an older devil and a younger devil. And the older devil writes a series of letters to the younger devil about how to ruin souls. Right? This is, it's really an ingenious but an extremely indirect way for us to see the point that catechism might teach us or that theology might teach us. And this is Lewis, I think, indicating to us, and Tolkien even more, is this way, that art operates indirectly when it operates at its best. So if you look at contemporary film, I'm going to try and put together one of Lewis's ideas with three selections from films and talk about them. If you try to put these things together, if you look at our contemporary landscape when it comes to film and television, there's been a kind of upsurge in what is called Christian films, right? There's a series of God Is Not Dead, Left Behind movies. These all arose sort of in the wake of the most inexplicable best-selling film, The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson, an R-rated film. And we could talk about this in the question period. I've got mixed judgments about that film. If certain things have been changed, I think it would have been one of the greatest religious films of all time. I still think it's got powerful things in it. But that film, an R-rated film, an R-rated religious film in Aramaic with subtitles. How much money do you think that's going to make at the box office? Nobody thought it was going to make anything. The highest grossing R-rated film of all time. So with the success of that, people said in Hollywood, who are nothing if not cynical and interested in money, they said there's a market, right? So Christian filmmakers started to become a bit more mainstream. And these explicitly Christian films fill a gap. I mean, parents want to know, can I take my kids to something that's going to affirm our faith and not be toxic for their souls? And those films do that. They're typically not really good art as films. And one of the problems is that they're overly didactic in a medium where didacticism doesn't work well. It's not that being didactic is bad. It's just that didactic has its proper medium, that is trying to teach directly. Right? So these films hit you over the head with messages. I would say in the same way that Hollywood films that are preaching a very liberal, progressive message also hit you over the head with messages. Neither one is going to rise to the level of real art. And if you're not already in the camp, they're also preaching to the choir in both of these things, right? And they're defining in and out groups. Well, art is not really about in and out groups. Art's about an appeal to the imagination that could strike someone who doesn't have the core beliefs of the person making the film and say, you know, that's really interesting. And if you're trying to make films that are going to evangelize the culture and not just preach to those who are already converted, you've got to make art that surprises people. So you've got to write books where you have a devil talking to another devil rather than just God talking to us. right? So art works by indirection. And Lewis was great at this. He was a master at this. And I think Tolkien even more so in some ways. One of the things that Lewis thought, and he's writing about this in the 50s and 60s, if you have to read one short book by Lewis, if you're interested in philosophical questions, The Abolition of Man by Lewis is his most brilliant and prophetic. All the stuff is really solid. But The Abolition of Man is a really brilliant and prophetic book. And in this, I'm going to really oversimplify this, but Lewis does really two things in this book. And everything that he saw there is coming to fruition even more in our own time because of advancements in technology and other things. But Lewis saw that the first thing was about language. That what was happening, and he picks up these seemingly innocent education books for children, and he starts analyzing the way they're teaching children to read literature. And they're teaching the children to read literature in a way that all of their judgments are, they're taught to think of those as merely subjective. Right? So the judgments don't really have to do with the way the world is. Aesthetic judgments about beauty, moral judgments about good or bad, what philosophers call epistemological judgments about truth and falsity. These are all about how I feel, not about the way the world is. While Lewis says this is complete nonsense as to how we talk. I mean, when we make judgments that's good or that's bad, we're not saying, yay, I like that. Or boo, right? We're actually, and the reason we get into arguments about these things, often futile arguments, is that the reason we can have arguments and we insist on having arguments is that we're actually arguing about the way the world is. We're not just expressing a preference, right? Where someone says, well, what do you like on the menu tonight? And I say, well, I feel like seafood, you're gonna have a Coke, you're gonna have a beer. But those are sort of subjective preferences. It makes no sense unless it's about your health to argue with somebody about what they're going to order. That's just what I like. Right? Well, Lewis sees what's going on in these textbooks is that they're trying to make all judgments like those preference judgments that we make when we go to eat, to a restaurant to order dinner. And Lewis says this is just false. It's also pernicious, right? Because what you end up with is everything being merely subjective, so that there is no good or evil, no true or false. Lewis connects that with this big modern project that goes back to early modern philosophers, claiming that through advanced technology and science, we would not only be able to make things a little bit better, but we would come to be masters and possessors of all of nature, so that nature would become a kind of raw material over which human will would exercise its control. The problem with that project is, it's actually been a somewhat successful project, and it's becoming more so in our time, is that the question is not raised as to what the limits are to how we use technology, how well we manipulate the external world. Lewis also saw that we would eventually turn this on our own natures. So we would eventually want to transform human nature into something that is not. And what happens at that point is, Lewis thinks the long-term effect of that is the abolition of man, the abolition of human nature, because there's no longer anything that we can point to and say, this is what it means to be a human. Well, we just made it something else, quite different. So Lewis saw this eugenics. He saw it in terms of what technology might be able to do. There are all sorts of examples of this in our own culture. So one of the things that is crucial in art for Lewis, as we begin to lose our moorings, as we begin to lose our faith in our moral language, as we begin to lose the sense of what it means to be human, art has to play a role for Lewis in helping us recover what's obvious. Right? The problem is if we start to construct everything about nature and human nature according to our will, then we lose a sense of what's obvious about what it means to be human. Right? Because it all becomes up for grabs, what it means to be human, what it means to be male or female, right? What it means when life begins, when life ends. All these things become up for grabs, and we lose our moorings, we lose our bearings. So Lewis thought that art in our time had to be about, this is one of the distinctive, it's always been about reminding us of what's obvious. So the fantasy world that Lewis constructs in Narnia as we enter into it, it reminds us of things of what it means to be human. It reminds us of the dangers of temptation, of treachery, of greed, right, of vices. And it reminds us of sacrifice for the good. But art in our time has got to do more than even that. It's got to remind us of what it means to be human. I want to make three suggestions and show three clips. For Lewis, the big temptation in this project of mastering nature is to think that we might be able to overcome death. And it's all really about some attempt to push death further away from us. It's about not realizing that we're mortal. Right? Both in what it aims at an indefinite extension of human life, and in what it assumes about who we are, that we become, in a sense, like God, and not like mortals who receive a moral law that we must obey, but we're the ones who then create. So the fundamental thing that we've got to be reminded of is that we're mortal. And that coming to terms with our mortality is something that we need to do as humans. It's also the case for Lewis that we need to be reminded by reference to our mortality of what it is that we ought to fight for and defend, and what it is and how it is that we ought to love. So I want to play this first clip. The point beneath some of these things that I've just mentioned is that for Lewis, the danger is for us that we no longer know how to name things properly. And that we lose the ability to name what's missing. If we feel a sense of frustration or loss in our lives, Shakespeare says this in King Lear. It sounds paradoxical at first. This is not the worst so long as we can say this is the worst. It's not a very uplifting saying that he gives us. This is not the worst so long as we can say this is the worst. What does he mean? Well, he means that if we can say this is the worst, we're not without hope because we realize that something's messed up. Right? The worst would be what? For everything to be really bad and for us not even be able to judge that it's bad. That's when we're lost. So our ability to say something's messed up is actually a hopeful thing. Right? We're not completely in despair. We can say, man, this is really messed up, whatever it might be. Right? Because then we can say, well, we can start to ask, well, what's messed up? How did it get messed up? How do we get out of it? Right? Well, this clip from Gravity, which has George Clooney and Sandra Bullock floating in outer space, the space station. They get this asteroid, a series of asteroids come through. They get separated. And at one point, Sandra Bullock is alone in this sort of space capsule floating in outer space. It's filmed by Alfonso Cuarón, who's a really gifted contemporary filmmaker. And I want to play this clip, if I can figure out how to do this. I'll probably erase everything. So watch this, and then... Get it to the next.
Next again.
Just click. Oh, there we go. Okay. That'll be next. This scene jumped out at me when I saw it. Think about how many times when you're watching mainstream films or television, people die. It happens a good bit in film and television. And, I mean, some people die without knowing they're going to die. They get killed, or they're in a car accident, or something happens accidentally, they die in their sleep. But there's still a lot of cases where characters are in the situation that Sandra Bullock's in here, where they have a sense that death is coming. Very rarely in popular film does a character begin to think and talk in the way Sandra Bullock does here, which is actually pretty astonishing. I think this is one of the ways in which Hollywood plays fast and loose with our ordinary experience, because I think most people, even if they're not religious, if they're thinking about their own death, they're wondering what's coming next, if anything. Right? But they're at least wondering about that, and they're framing these questions. She does this rather remarkable thing. She takes the general principle, I know we're all going to die, and particularizes it, but I'm going to die today. Right? So she's directly facing, and notice how it sharpens things to be in that situation where you think, I could die today. This is why the saints meditated on death. Right? Why Ignatius of Loyola, when he begins his great series of meditations for the retreat, there's a meditation on sin and a meditation on death. And the particularization of not just all men are mortal, Socrates is mortal, Socrates is a man, Socrates is mortal, but I'm going to die today, potentially, sharpens the mind, right, to recognize one's own. But then the other remarkable thing about this is what she goes on to say, which is she mourns what's missing, or she names what's missing in her own life. Will you pray for me? She's made some radio contact. You can hear some voice there, but it seems like it's Chinese, and she doesn't understand that person. That person understands her, but she's having an imaginary sort of doubt. Will you pray for me? Who will mourn for my soul? I could pray, but nobody ever taught me how. It's actually a pretty sophisticated process of naming what's missing right now in her life and what's been missing up to that point that has led her to be unprepared for this moment of death, right? And it just jumped out at me when I saw this scene. Nothing like this happens in your typical Hollywood film. But this is a scene that names the fact that I'm mortal, and not in an abstract way, but I could die today. Which is true for all of us, whether we're floating in outer space or standing or sitting right here, right now. Right? And it sharpens the mind. Am I prepared for this? And then immediately thinking about who will mourn for me, who will pray for me, and whether I have been taught how to pray. It's actually a remarkable scene in this film. And so, I mean, we could go into it. I'm happy to talk about this further. One of the reasons I think that we resist, and in our culture there's a greater resistance to, a greater aversion to talking and thinking about death. It's something that human beings have always been averse to. There's nothing new about that, right? Who really wants to talk and think about death? We say that's morbid, right? Well, it's harder in our culture, partly because of medical technology, and doctors have written books recently about how it's become increasingly difficult in some circumstances to have that conversation with a family or with an individual patient, that we've exhausted the reasonable medical resources, right? There's something natural about us wanting to keep people we love around, and if we're alive, about wanting to stay with the people we love. That's all very healthy. Where we're in a situation, our culture is, that we've invested so much hope in medical technology to keep deferring the moment of death, right? That it's harder for, we don't want to prepare for death. We don't want to do what Sandra Bullock does here, right? Which is to ask the question about, am I prepared? Should I pray? Who will pray for me? So it's harder in our culture. And I think it's also harder because we do have a kind of increase in, we're more detached from our religious traditions. So if you don't really have a clue about what might happen next, and you have no real hope with respect to what's going to happen next, it's actually kind of rational to say, I don't want to think or talk about death. Right? Because what would you do if you started to think or talk about death except despair? So in a culture where there is less identification of the notion of living after death, less hope in things like resurrection, less hope that things will be better in another life. It's actually a rational move on our part, in some sense, to say, I don't want to think or talk about it. So, but if we were to do this, there's the question as to how we should lead our lives. There's also this big issue of whether we can make death a friend or not. Some philosophers talk about meditate on death so much that it's no longer an enemy, but a friend. And there are debates in the philosophical and theological literature on this. I want to play this clip next from Christopher Nolan's first Batman film, the trilogy. I think Christopher Nolan, Quarren's a good filmmaker. I think Christopher Nolan sometimes is a great filmmaker, contemporary filmmaker. And he takes this Batman myth and superhero and kind of invests it with really interesting film. Remember when I saw this first one, I just wanted to go talk to somebody about the film. It doesn't happen to me very often, sadly, because films are just not today very often where you come out and you think, I gotta talk to someone. What did I just see? Right? And those moments, for me, those are the great moments watching a film, where you come out and you think, what just happened there? And the first time it happened to me with Nolan's films was almost 20 years ago when the film Memento, which is a great, really interesting film that he put out. And I remember going to see it. I didn't know who Christopher Nolan was, but it just kept hanging around every week in the top 10 films. Just kept, I had a friend of Boston College, said, we gotta go check this thing out. We went to see it. And sat there in the theater for like 20 minutes afterwards, just talking about what just happened. And Nolan's one of those, not all of his films reach this level, but when he's good, he's really good. This is the first Batman film after he's been with the League of Shadows. He's going to go back to Gotham.
Master Wayne, you've been gone a long time.
Yes, I have.
You look very fashionable. Apart from the money. Are you coming back to Gotham for long, sir?
As long as it takes. I'm going to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city.
Did it?
In a way, their murder shot the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
I assume that as you're taking on the underworld, this symbol is a persona to protect those you care about from reprisals.
You think about Rachel?
I treat her. I was thinking of myself.
Have you told anyone I'm coming back?
I just couldn't figure the legal ramifications of bringing you back from the dead.
Dead?
You've been gone 7 years.
You had me declared dead?
Well, actually, it was Mr. Earl. He's taken the company public. He wanted to liquidate your majority shareholding. Those shares are worth quite a bit of money.
Well, that's a good thing I left everything to you, then.
Quite so, sir. And you can borrow the rolls if you like. Just bring it back with a full tank.
So what I like about what Nolan did with the Batman films is that you sort of take a worst-case scenario. And we do that a lot in our films. We've got apocalyptic films, we've got science fiction films, all of which are about worst-case scenarios, right? We've got a lot of worries in our souls that these films feed into, a lot of anxiety just beneath the surface about where we're headed as a people and a culture and a civilization. This takes the worst-case scenario in the sense that it imagines a world. Let me back up for 1 second. So he's coming back from the League of Shadows. He's obviously this elemental thing that he's going to adopt is the Bat. Right? He's going to become the Bat. Counters fear with fear. The other really interesting thing about this, and why I love Batman is among the superheroes, he really doesn't have superhero powers. Right? He's got his bat stuff and his gadgets and his cars and the Batmobile, maybe Robin, depending on which tradition of Batman you're watching. But he adopts this image, and notice what he says there, people need examples. And I think this is something that Lewis certainly saw, right? What we need is not just a listing of commandments, although we need commandments. Don't do this, do this. In order to really lead a good life, we need examples, we need a vocabulary, we need stories of people who are courageous, people who are heroic, people who are hopeful. These are the things that feed our moral imagination. And as we get older, these are the things that we implicitly draw upon when we have to face tough situations. Right? The problem with much of our kind of the toxic elements in our popular culture, I mean, one problem we see obviously is that parts of it influence young men who are already disposed toward violence to want to imitate certain things. But let's be careful with how we do that, right? How we assess that, because it's not as if just watching a Tarantino film, even 20 times, is going to cause somebody to go out and enact the violence in the film, right? An awful lot has to have gone wrong in the soul, particularly, let's face it, particularly of young men. There aren't a lot of young women who were watching these things and going out and shooting up people. An awful lot has to have gone wrong in the soul of a young man before that film triggers something. Right? So the films can have a bad impact, but an awful lot already has to have gone wrong. And that's not even the general problem with this. I mean, when that happens, it's awful, right, in our culture, where violence is explicitly acted out on a large scale. The real problem in our culture is that is the kind of atrophying of the moral imagination of our youth. So in our culture, we increasingly, young people increasingly live in kind of vacuums, right, where parents may or may not be around, they may or may not have a school community that sort of develops their moral imagination in healthy ways, they may or may not have a church, they may or may not, probably aren't reading things that are going to develop their moral imagination. Into the souls of those kids, the bad parts of Hollywood are happy to march in and set up camp. And they're happy to exact a lot of money from those, from the wallets of those souls as well. But what they're likely to do then is to create people who are jaded very early on, who are cynical, who are apt to act out in violence, not necessarily on a large scale, but toward others. They don't trust people. They see everything as a kind of competition. They're cynical. They don't have any examples of courage, of hope. That's the bad thing in the culture. What Bruce Wayne's pointing to is that what you need is a culture where there are striking examples that inspire people. Think about Bruce Wayne in this first, after he adopts the Batman. He's on the side of buildings in Gotham, right, with the cape. You've got these grace spires. What does he look like? He looks like a gargoyle on a medieval cathedral. And that's what he looks like. But Bruce Wayne Batman in Gotham is a gargoyle in a godless Gotham. This is a world from which divine guidance and judgment appears to have vanished. It's a world in which there is no natural standard of good and evil. And even human civil justice, the police and the courts, with some exceptions, are completely corrupt. And the innocent people are cowering in fear. These films take the worst case scenario. Divine justice seems to be gone. Natural justice seems to be gone. Human justice seems to be gone. What's left? What's left is Batman. What does Batman represent? Batman represents the desire in the human soul for justice. That even when we've lost our sense of God, our sense of natural order, and we don't have a civil society that's working, even then, the soul can still be stirred to hate evil and to want to protect the innocent. And that's what Batman represents. If you look at the top-selling, and we can talk about this afterward, there are mixed things about it. If you look at the top-selling film since 2000, there's this great geeky film website that I check out occasionally called Box Office Mojo, where you go and they can give you what's the top-selling film for last week, last month, last year. They can adjust it for inflation. They can do it by rating. So if you look back since 2000, you're going to find certain kinds of films. You're going to find Star Wars films. You're going to find Harry Potter films. You'll find the first Narnia film, not so much after that. Kind of went down. No, Lord of the Rings, right? You're going to find Lord of the Rings. You're going to find all kinds of superhero films. Any film with a spider in it, top 10. Make a film with a spider in it if you want to be a filmmaker. These are all, these fantasy films have, they're better and worse. I think the Batman films are good. Lord of the Rings is fabulous. But they're all films about quests. They're films about battles between good and evil. Batman's saying there is a hunger in the human soul for examples, for language, for stories, right, that feed us and inspire us. And he's attempting to give that. So I want to just make a couple, show a clip and make a couple comments and then show a final clip, and then I'm happy to take questions. Actually, another clip that's not here, but I'm just going to tell you about that and then show this last one. There's this great scene in, you all know the Lord of the Rings stories, and you know that Peter Jackson, one of the things he did was try to get female characters a more prominent role than they have in Tolkien's books, although in the appendices of Tolkien's books, there's a much bigger role. So the Arwen Aragorn great love story, which is in the books, and Arwen is an elf princess and is destined for immortality, and her father, realizing that she's fallen in love with Aragorn, it's Viggo Mortensen and Liv Tyler, you think, well, they've got to be together. Somehow this has to work out, but they don't quite look that way in the books, but in Hollywood films they do. When her father realizes that she's fallen in love with Aragorn, who's immortal, he says, I've seen your future, and all that's there is death. So she decides to give up her love for Aragorn and is heading off in the film. She's heading off to what are called the Undying Lands. It's actually a beautiful, beautiful scene. And across her path races this boy. And then she has a kind of vision of this boy in the arms of Aragorn. And she turns around and leaves this group that's going to the Undying Lands and goes back to her father. And says to him, you had a vision of the future. He says, yes, all I saw in your future is pain and suffering and death. And she said, no, there's also life. There's a child. Now, interestingly, we could debate, for those of you, if I've got some big Tolkien fans in here, about what Jackson got wrong. This is something that Jackson added that I think actually makes a Tolkien point. So in the book, she does give up the Undying Lands to be with Aragorn. When they were filming this, from what I've read about this, Peter Jackson had a couple of assistant directors who were women who said, you know, they sort of said something like this, I don't care how good looking Aragorn is. What a great warrior he is. To give up immortality for this guy, right? This is a guy fantasy. Right? I'm so great that this beautiful woman's going to give up immortality for me. They said the motivation, they were not giving her enough motivation. So they added the child to the scene. Right? It's also, I love this, not just because I think it's actually, there are other cases where Jackson changed things and I shouldn't have done that. This case, I actually think it works. And it also makes a really nice counter to almost every romantic comedy that you've watched in the last 30 years. There are some exceptions, but that's why I said almost. Because romantic comedies today are about all kinds of crazy things happening, and then the couple coming together. What's almost never involved in that is the recognition that when you look at that potential spouse, you're seeing children. Almost never in our culture. That's false. I mean, we may get to the point where we've been so programmed, as Lewis says, the abolition of man and woman. We may get to the point where we're so programmed in thinking about love that it doesn't have any connection to having children. Right? But I think it still is natural for lots of people, as they're falling in love, to think, not only do I find this person witty, most of the time, attractive, and admirable, but I also think about, yeah, this is the person I want to have children with. That's natural. What Tolkien is recovering and Jackson, even more than Tolkien in that, is something that's natural, but we're in danger of losing. How do we love in the face of death? Well, we love not just to remember the dead, but we love also because we have hope in the future. Right? And we hope in children and the propagation of the race and then other things. So I wanted to say something about, and I'll end with this other clip, but I wanted to say something about recovering from this project of trying to control nature to the point where we eliminate evil and even death. How do we recover from that? Well, we recover certain basic facts about what it means to be human, perhaps the most basic of which is that we're mortal. And then in light of that mortality, what do we fight for? How and why do we love? This last clip that I want to show is from The Tree of Life. This is a film that was known, Terrence Malick, who actually grew up in Waco. And this film is set in Waco, sort of begins this cosmic thing, and then it settles down in the center of the universe in Waco, Texas. Which is now, you know, with Fixer Upper being there. Here's an interesting fact about the silos at Fixer Upper. Chip and Joanna are both Baylor alums. There were more visits last year to the silos than to the Alamo, which is great for Waco, but really bad for Western civilization. I see people coming out of the Hilton looking and seeing the same. This is a pilgrim site for lots of people. It's kind of interesting and scary a little bit. So Malick grew up in Waco. He now lives in Austin. He's a great indie filmmaker. This film is really long. It has a big creation scene. I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it was famous when it first came out for the number of people who just walked out. So I'm not going to burden you with too much of it. I hope you'll not walk out. But I want to play the beginning, and then I'll just make a comment about this, and then we'll take some questions. This is slightly longer than the first clip, of course. Don't leave yet.
There are two ways through life. The way of nature and the way of grace. You have to choose which one you'll follow. Grace doesn't try to please itself. Being slighted, forgotten, disliked. Accepts insults and injuries. Thank you.
So there's a couple things about this. I mean, that last line about finding reasons to be unhappy when the beauty of the world is surrounding you. Like what art like Grace is designed at its best to do is to disabuse us of that, right? To move us, not to just reason with us, but to move us in such a way that we encounter that beauty. And we're moved by it in such a way that we give up our gripes. We give up our selfishness. We give up our narrowness, because beauty draws us, makes a claim on us. And this is a short section. You may or may not like the longer version of this film. My oldest daughter really likes this. My youngest daughter has never forgiven me for taking the receipts. So people have very different judgments about this film. But it's a really interesting film that does a lot of stuff. You can see there's a big creation scene, as I mentioned. And then you can already see the way the camera angles are sort of horizontal and then strong verticals, right? Up toward, through the tall live oaks and toward the sun. He does that throughout. And I think the interesting suggestion is, you hear someone talking at the beginning, right? Brother, mother, it was they who drew me to you. Well, who's the you, right? And it turns out it's God. And that the characters are in not just dialogue with one another, but with God in this film. This is, again, something that, just like with the Sandra Bullock scene and the Lord of the Rings scene, this is something that happens a lot in our souls that Hollywood never captures. Right? We have conversations. We have crazy conversations in our own head, too. But we also have conversations sort of in our head that are with God. Right? Even when we're not praying. Why is this happening? What does this mean? Where are you? This film is about those questions. But it's also structured in such a way that to answer those questions, we need to look at our lives not just horizontally, but vertically. Right? That the key thing for us is not just trying to make sense of this, this, and this, but seeing how something descends from above into our midst, some kind of revelation that helps us to see how these events ought to be understood. Right? And that's also what art can do for us. It can give us a perspective on ordinary, everyday events that's much bigger and much richer than if we're just looking here, here, and here. Right? So that the looking at things not just in terms of one event after another on the horizontal plane, but the vertical plane, art opens that up for us. Let me stop there. You guys have been very patient. Thanks. Questions.
How do you see that, like what Lewis described as like the shift into decisions being of like preferential nature? How do you see that kind of causing the degradation of the moral imagination?
So here's there's a bigger argument as to how you get to the degradation of the imagination completely. What it does is to destroy potentially, right? If it really impacts us when we take this over, it destroys our trust in what we do naturally, which is to make judgments about things. Now, this is not the same as judging the souls of other people, right? Separate these things out. Right? So, it's one thing to say don't judge the soul of someone. It's another thing to say, I'm not going to make judgments about other people. And usually, I'm not going to make judgments about myself either, right? Because most of the time, there's some self-exculpatory process going on where we're not, there are things about our own souls that we don't want to look at. But it's really important to make judgments. I mean, you need to make accurate, informed judgments. And you want to make judgments that lead you to greater wisdom and deeper understanding and to better ways of life. We're making judgments all the time. Even to say you shouldn't judge is a judgment, right? So this is something we really can't get around. If we start to think that all of our moral judgments are like cheerleading for something or being against something, that's really false to our language. We don't use language in that way. I mean, as I just told you before, there's a difference between how we think about preferences with a menu and how we think about human acts, right? And when we make judgments, that's good or that's bad. And we can't do it practically either. We always end up making judgments like this. So that kind of relativism is, strictly speaking, impossible. Right? They're great, for those of you who are Coen Brothers fans, there are great scenes in The Big Lebowski about the nihilists and how they're cowards and they're not to be feared. And really, that's unlivable. I mean, these people are posing, right? They're not serious. But we can be duped into thinking that, because we can be told that making judgments about good and bad makes us people who other people don't want to hang around with, or it makes us mean or something like that. We need to do these things mercifully with wisdom and prudence, but the idea that we're not making judgments just falsifies our own experience, right? So it messes us up in that way. And if we're looking at stories, having that philosophy in our head, we're going to be blocked from stories that actually move us. So what do we see that's admirable in Batman? There are also lots of temptations Batman has to worry about, and he's in danger of going bad in lots of scenes. But what's admirable about that? Well, what's admirable about that is the willingness to risk everything courageously to help people that he doesn't have to help, right? Because he identifies with the city and he identifies with the people. Well, is that admirable or not? Seems to me that's admirable. You could, as Alfred says to him at one point, don't get lost in the monster. Right, there are real dangers with what he's doing. But the initial instinct is an admirable instinct. When Sandra Bullock, in that clip I showed first, is trying to come to terms with her own mortality, is this something we ought to think is admirable or not? We could debate that, right? But it seems to me there's a good case to be made that she sees herself as focusing on what she's about as a person, what the whole shape of her life is about, in a way that she maybe has never done. This is important and significant. That can feed our moral imagination. But if we are operating with the view constantly that debunks that, right, and says, well, no, there really aren't judgments about better and worse ways of life or how I can live better or worse. I mean, Lewis said in The Abolition of Man and elsewhere, says, look, an awful lot of our culture, of the sophisticated elements in our culture, is always about looking through things, seeing through things. So I see through that. I see through this politician's attempt to win my vote. I see through this advertising. I see through religion, right, as being just a bunch of myths that keeps people under control. People are always claiming that they're seeing through things. And Lewis says, well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the point of seeing through is to actually see something, right? To see through and see nothing is to be blind. So Lewis is fine if we want to say there are all sorts of things that are disordered, artificial and not natural, fake, whatever. But Lewis says simply to strike this pose where you're the person who always sees through stuff, right? We do this with relationships, right? When we're questioning the people that we're dating or something. We start to see through them. Right, and think that we've got them figured out. Well, okay, but if we do that with every relationship, we're going to end up really unhappy. Right? The point is to see through something that's hollow to see something that's real and substantial. Right. So, but if we have this view that all of our moral language is just arbitrary, all we're going to do is see through everything that someone puts forward as saying, this is good and admirable. Oh, I see through that. Well, then you see nothing. And then your imagination is just empty. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the back.
Is art able to be perverted so that it no longer orients us on this plane of like a vertical back to our original like horizontal plane? And if so, how do we determine that it is in that perverted state, and where do we draw that line?
Well, this is a really complicated question. I mean, I think there's lots of toxic stuff in so-called art, but we could say, you're just a lot better off not watching that.
Right.
It's more difficult. And if we've lost the ability to say that, then we're back with the people who don't really believe that our language and our judgments can have a purchase on reality with respect to good and evil. So the problems are deeper than just the art. Some problem in our soul. And that's a very different question from saying whether we ought to have censorship or not. It's a completely separate. It's connected in some way, because if you see really toxic stuff, you think that's bad. It's at least bad for children to see, right? And you do have this tendency. It's probably peaked in Hollywood, but you know, I noticed at a certain point 10 years or so ago that PG-13 movies were like what R movies were like 10 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And PG movies were like PG-13 movies. So Hollywood's happy to have a kind of general dumbing down, because then they can make, I'm going to just say it, they can make crap and make money off it. Right? They don't have to be artistically talented or really tell substantive stories. They can just tell stuff that we're willing cynically to laugh at and enjoy because it's appealing to our bases. And if they can form our souls in such a way that that's what we want, they make a lot of money without any talent. Right? So they've got vested interest in dumbing us down. So the more difficult question, though, is what do you do about art that contains things that, taken in isolation, you might think that's bad? But in the scope of the whole story, the story's not evil or nihilistic or degraded. So you can have degraded characters in a story, and they can do lots of bad things. There might be limits as to how much you would want to see them actually do, right? But they can do bad things and the story not be bad, because the story itself is showing us that this is self-destructive in some way. I mean, Shakespeare's great at this, right? A tragedy like Macbeth is about Macbeth's own self-destruction, because he knows before he commits the murder. Knew that happened in Macbeth, right? I'm not giving away the plot. He knows before he does it that he's doing wrong and it's going to destroy his soul. He does lots of other horrible things and has horrible imaginations over the course of the film. But Macbeth is a kind of degraded nihilist by the end of that play. Shakespeare is not a degraded nihilist, because Shakespeare is showing where this leads, right? So you can have characters who are awful, and simply to have a character's awful, also to have endings that are not happy, is not necessarily a bad thing. The question is how we feel about the bad, how the film or the story is trying to make us feel as an audience about the bad things. King Lear has a dreadful ending, right? Lots of films and television shows that we watch have dreadful endings. That's not the most important thing. The most important thing is whether in the audience how are we inclined to feel about that? If we are inclined by what the maker of the story or the film is intending, if we're inclined to feel tremendous sorrow and loss, that's not a bad film. Because that's the natural reaction to death and suffering and horrible things happening. If we're inclined just to be entertained by it, that's different. Right? Suzanne Collins, in writing The Hunger Games, said that she was inspired to start writing those books during the first Iraq War. She was flipping around on TV and she went from like a CNN, that was when Wolf Blitzer became famous, right? CNN coverage of the war to some reality TV thing. Right? The Kardashians weren't around, but if the Kardashians had been around, you'd want to go back to the war very quickly. And what she was noticing was the way in which in her own soul, just flipping around like this, there was not, it's like, oh, that's awful, ooh, that's crazy and interesting. Right? The way in which our emotions in the face of awful things can be flattened out. Right? And the Hunger Games itself, right, the Hunger Games is set up by this power, centralized power, to pit innocent children to fight to the death against one another. Well, what are we doing as viewers of that film? Aren't we being entertained by innocent children killing one another in the film? Suzanne Collins is posing in the book and then in the film version the question for us, what draws us to violence? Because violence and sexuality are both deeply intensify our experience. And that's because there are great things at stake. Contemporary Hollywood doesn't know there are great things at stake, but they know there are intensifiers, sexuality and violence, especially when they're mixed. What are we after when we're watching something this violent? Whether it's the evening news, war footage, or video games, or even the Hunger Games. Suzanne Collins is posing the question to us, how healthy is our interest in violence? Because what? We learn at the very beginning that what does this do? It binds the society together. It's the big entertainment in that society, right, in the Hunger Games. Now, it turns out that if we keep going, we've got good people to root for who are trying to undermine the whole system, especially captains, right? So we're actually given, but at the beginning, before we have that, we're in the same position as the people who are running things who are being entertained by violence to the death between innocent people. It's forcing us to ask the question, what draws me to this? Is that healthy in my soul or not? So that's another question that we need to ask in a culture, a pop culture that's saturated with graphic violence and sometimes with graphic sexuality as well. What draws us to these things? Human beings have always been drawn to these things. Read Oedipus Rex. It's got both, right? And it's got weird perversion in it. But it's not in the end about being entertained by either perversion or violence. It's about learning something deep about the human condition. Right? And also for the ancients, as for Shakespeare, most of the violence happened off stage. It's rare to present it directly, and that's because the worry about the way in which both violence and sexuality overwhelm the imagination. They don't expand the imagination and allow it to be free. They, in a sense, enslave it to the image. So we see violence or we see sexuality and we're drawn to it. We're drawn to what? We're not drawn to an enriched imagination that's moving elsewhere. We're drawn to that image. And we can become addicted to the image in either case. Those are really unhealthy things. And with that stuff, we've just got to exercise temperance and asceticism. Got to be very careful about that. Doesn't mean that seeing an image that's sexual or an image of violence is going to destroy our souls. That's not what I'm saying. But we've got to be careful when the mechanism that the filmmaker's using is simply to enslave our imagination to the image. Right? And that's a judgment call. Because if you take a series like Breaking Bad, which I think was a great TV series, a few years back, it's really about the slow decline of a soul into vice and evil. And it's about the connection between envy and pride and wrath. And it's one of the best descriptions in contemporary film or television ever. But there are scenes in there where they're playing with us and getting us to cheer for somebody who's really bad. And then the next scene, we see that he's really bad. And we're not just surprised by that, but we've got to go back and say, what was drawing me to this evil character? Milton does the same thing with Satan in Paradise Lost. He makes him an attractive character, and then he says, oh, what are you being duped by? This is where it leads. That's great art. Great art will sometimes dupe us into cheering for the bad guy, into actually being attracted to evil, so that in the very next scene, it can show us how easily tempted we are by that. But there's got to be that next scene, right? It's not just that the art is leading us toward evil. Sorry, that was too long a question.
Could you please talk about Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ and The Enslavement of the Imagination?
Yeah, so I think that's... I wrote a piece about that film, or a couple of pieces about it. But one was, I forget what M. Night Shyamalan film came out right about that time. It was when M. Night's career started to go down, which was right after The Village. I forget. The Lady in the Water or something, or The Pool, whatever that was, right afterward. But, you know, Mel was in Signs with Shyamalan. And what I said was, these guys should make films together from now on. Because Shyamalan ran out of ideas. Recently been a little bit better, but he basically ran out of ideas. But he's a really gifted filmmaker. And he's really gifted at suspense and indirection. He's great at that. Mel Gibson's got all kinds of ideas. some of them good, some of them not so good, but he's got real ideas, and he knows how to make films. The problem, I mean, I think there are some legitimate questions about how Jewish characters are presented in the film that could be raised. The bigger problem with the film, and this is where I think Shyamalan would have been a great editor of the film, is that there are just too many extended scenes that are nothing but the flaying of Christ's flesh. Now, in one sense, what Gibson was doing is a healthy corrective to the kind of saccharine view of the cross, the passion, the crucifixion, the death of Christ. I mean, after all, he was subject to the two greatest punishments that the Roman nation, which was really good at, the Roman Republic, which was really good at punishing people. They were really creative about this, and awful. I mean, the flogging and then crucifixion are, I mean, these are the two greatest punishments known to the ancient world, both in terms of physical abuse of the body and in terms of the dishonor that's done to the person on whom these are inflicted. And our general tendency in our culture has been to downplay that. Right, so, and Mel, you can see Mel saying, I'm going in the opposite direction on this, right? Because Mel historically had been really good at violence. And he's really good at the way in which violence is an intensifier of experience. But there's a point at which the intensification loses its power and it numbs us. Right, and there's that scene in the flogging where Christ falls down. He's been, I mean, it's just horrifying. And he gets back up and it's as if he's looking at them saying, sort of macho Jesus. Is that all you got? He's looking at the guy, right? And I'm thinking, that's wrong. That's not what we ought to be thinking about here. Right? So there was a bit of an excessive macho Jesus in the film, I think. There's also the problem of just too many extended scenes that are just about physical brutality and tearing of flesh and blood. The problem is that the imagination, after a while, it numbs us, right? Now, the places where it really works is in the scenes where he splices Mary, and there's that great, my favorite scene in the whole film, it's what I often show when I'm doing a different version of this talk, is when he's carrying the cross, and Mary has the memory of him as a child falling. It's a really beautiful scene, and she rushes to him as a child after he's fallen and lifts him up into her arms. And she sees him, she's sort of looking down a passageway, and sees him falling with this huge thud. And she runs to him, right, and embraces his face. And he looks at her and says, "Behold, I make all things new," and stands up and continues. So it's a really, that scene alone is just absolutely brilliant. But the pain and suffering is humanized by this flashback to his childhood and about Mary's affection, by Mary's affection. There are too many scenes in the film that don't have that. Right? And so I think if it had been 20 minutes shorter, it would have been a much better film. Because it wouldn't have risked numbing us with excessive direct presentation. It's not that I'm downplaying the significance of what Jesus suffered. I think Mel makes us see that and feel it. But too much of it deadens our souls, our emotions. There's only so much of that we can take, and then we just become numb. Does that? Yes?
Me?
Yeah.
So my question comes from February's First Things. It's not my own question.
Oh my goodness. I'm in trouble now.
Is there a compelling reason that 21st century philosophers, theologians, and tech industrialists...
I need some water.
Frankenstein.
Should read
Frankenstein.
I assume the answer, I haven't read that article, I assume the answer is yes. I would say yes. This is actually a really interesting question, thank you. I don't know how we're doing on time. This is needs to be the last question, that's fine. It's the beginning in a way, and it's directly connected to the abolition of man. Right, because it's the I have a hard time thinking about that without thinking about the Gene Wilder Young Frankenstein, which is one of the greatest comedies of all time. But the story itself is about the way in which human ambition backfires, right? It's precisely about our attempting to be masters and possessors of nature and not being able to pull it off. It's also about the way, and this is one of the things Lewis is saying, right, that it's also about the way, and science fiction films are often about this, it's about the way in which what we've created, as Macbeth says, returns to plague the inventor. Right? I mean, The Matrix is about the way in which we create AI, artificial intelligence, and then it turns against us. Right? And that's when the war starts. Frankenstein is sort of the first novel to outline this plot, right? Where modernity has lost, we as modern human beings have lost our bearings. We no longer take from nature a sense of our place in it and what the limits are on the exercise of our power. So a very important theme in Pope Francis Laudato Si. Everybody thinks, you know, that was just about climate change. Well, it's about climate change in the first few pages. But it's really about this problem of modern man as maker, that homo faber. And the problem for us as makers is we have no sense of our own limits with respect to external nature or internal nature. And Frankenstein is one of the first stories about the way in which thinking that technology can do everything for us is naive and damaging. Right? And this, you know, this came into American culture after the Second World War, because what helped us win the Second World War was our superior technology. It wasn't just the courage of our troops. It was certainly that. But we also believed, the West believed, in the superiority of its technology. And people like Lewis were worried at that time. Lewis's writings about in the 40s, he writes the education in wartime, learning in wartime, justifying continuing to learn, even though there are all sorts of awful things going on. But Lewis is worried about something that a Catholic like Jacques Maritain is worried about at the same time. The danger for them with the Second World War was that we could lose by winning. What did they mean by that? They meant that the very means that allowed us to win, namely our technological superiority, could lead us to think that we could solve every problem through technology. And the Frankenstein story and lots of subsequent stories in science fiction are about the way in which that's a myth, a dangerous myth. And the fact that these science fiction stories are so popular in our culture indicates, I think, that we have anxieties about this. Right? We don't buy the happy picture that technology is going to do it all. And at some level, subconsciously at least, just beneath the surface, we're really worried that by throwing everything into technology, we're going to lose everything, that it's all going to backfire on us. And almost all of our science fiction films have that kind of Frankenstein narrative to them. Thank you for that question. Thanks.